Okay, so today we're going to dive into something pretty foundational, right? When can someone actually step up and say, hey, this public entity, like a university, messed up when they changed their rules?
Yeah, and we're going to unpack all that through this fascinating case. Allen v. University of Washington, decided back in 2000.
Perfect. And just to bring everyone up to speed, you know, sometimes these legal concepts can feel a little abstract, so we're going to make this super practical.
Absolutely. And we'll see why this matters so much if you ever find yourself questioning how public institutions do their thing, you know, make decisions.
Because at the end of the day, it boils down to who actually gets their day in court.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
All right. So let's set the stage. We've got Margaret Allen, and she's going up against the University of Washington, the UW.
Right.
The whole thing centers on how they changed their faculty code, but to really get why this is a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
We need to go back a bit.
Way back. Back to 1989, there's this sexual harassment complaint against a professor, Graham Allen. And guess what?
I'm guessing he got fired.
Well, the university initially tried to, yeah. But then a faculty committee got involved. They reviewed everything and actually decided to reinstate him.
So he kept his job.
He did. But here's where it gets interesting. Margaret Allen, the one who ends up suing later, she actually testified in these proceedings.
Oh, wow.
And she wasn't just there casually. She was under subpoena.
So legally obligated to be there.
Right. But the story doesn't end there.
I bet it doesn't.
In 1991, the student who brought the initial complaint, she sued the university.
Directly.
Directly. They ended up reaching a settlement. And you know what was a big part of that settlement?
Tell me.
The university had to revamp its faculty code. Especially the part about handling student complaints against faculty.
So this one case triggered a whole system change.
Exactly. Now, fast forward to 1994. The UW finally makes these changes, puts them into action. But, and this is Margaret Allen's whole point, they did it just by a faculty vote.
So, like, internally.
Mm-hmm. And her argument is, hold on. This is about administrative procedure, how the university functions. You can't just change the rules without following the proper process. And that process is laid out in Washington State's Administrative Procedure Act, the APA.
That's the big one.
It is. And that law usually requires things like notifying the public about proposed rule changes, giving people a chance to comment, that kind of stuff.
So transparency, basically.
Yeah. But the UW had their own take on this. They said these changes, they fall under an exemption in the APA.
Okay, so a loophole.
Kind of. This exemption, it basically covers rules about employment within the university. Their reasoning was, since these changes are about how they deal with faculty when there are student complaints, it's all internal employment stuff.
So they're saying we don't have to follow all those APA steps.
Exactly. And that sets up this whole legal battle. But before we get to who's right and wrong, the court had to figure out something first.
Yeah, whether she even gets to be in court.
Exactly. They had to figure out if Margaret Allen even had the right to bring this case in the first place. And that, my friend, is what we call standing.
Standing. It's the gatekeeper.
It is. It's that initial hurdle anyone who wants to challenge what an agency did has to clear. And luckily for us, Washington's APA in section 34.05.530 of the Revised Code of Washington, to be precise, lays out a very clear three-part test.
Love a good test.
Oh, me too.
So let's break it down piece by piece. What's the first thing someone needs to prove to have standing?
All right. First up, prejudice.
Okay. Not prejudice like we usually think of it.
No, no. This is legal prejudice. Oh. And for you to have standing, this means the agency's action, whatever they did, has to have actually harmed you. Or it's very likely that it will harm you.
And it can't be like, oh, I'm just a little annoyed.
Right. Not just a theoretical thing. It has to be a real, concrete impact on your own interests.
It's like a punch in the gut.
Exactly.
Tangible.
All right. So that's one. What's hurdle number two? Hurdle number two is all about what we call the zone of interest. It's asking, are the things you're complaining about in your lawsuit actually related to the purpose of the laws or rules that the agency was supposed to be thinking about when they made their decision?
Okay. So like, if a rule is supposed to make a campus safer for students, but I'm suing because I think they didn't do enough about parking.
Yeah, you're probably not in the zone of interests.
Right. My parking woes, even if they're totally legitimate, they're not what that rule was designed to address.
Exactly. The harm you've suffered, it has to be connected to what the rule was actually trying to achieve.
Got it. So it's not enough to just be harmed. It has to be the right kind of harm. What's the final piece of the puzzle?
The final piece is redressability.
Now that's a mouthful.
It is, but it's a simple idea. Imagine a court agrees with you, they rule in your favor. will that actually fix the problem you've suffered?
So it's about whether the court can actually do something meaningful.
Right. If a court victory wouldn't really change your situation, if it wouldn't undo the harm, then you probably don't have standing.
Makes sense. So you've got to show you were harmed, the harm is related to the rule at hand, and a court win actually helps you. Those are the three tests.
Exactly.
Now let's apply these to Margaret Allen.
Okay.
The court ultimately said she didn't have the right to sue.
Right.
Let's start with prejudice. Why did they say she didn't show enough harm?
The court looked at her situation and said, she's not directly affected by these new disciplinary procedures. She's not faculty facing them. She's not a student who might be using them.
So the court's saying it's not personal enough.
Kind of. Her being a witness in her husband's case, that was in the past. And any future involvement, who knows? They saw that as too hypothetical.
But what about her connection to her husband, the professor? Didn't she argue that these rules could hurt his job and therefore their finances?
Well, she did. She brought up the idea of community property, you know, her legal interest in her husband's income and his job.
Seems pretty direct to me.
But the court saw it as indirect, almost a ripple effect, not a direct hit. They said her finances being affected depended on the rules actually impacting her husband's job negatively, which they thought was just a possibility, not a certainty.
So again, too speculative.
Right. And standing needs a much more direct injury to her own legal interests.
Gotcha. So they said no to prejudice. Then there's that second part, the zone of interest.
Right.
What was the court's reasoning there?
Basically, they said the university's main goal with these rule changes, especially after that settlement with the student, was to create a fair process for handling student complaints. That was their focus.
Makes sense.
Margaret Allen's focus seemed to be more about due process for faculty and maybe preventing something similar from happening to her husband again. The court said those are valid concerns, but they're not really what these specific rule changes were aimed at.
So her reasons, even if valid, weren't in line with what the rules were designed to do.
Precisely.
What about the last part, redressability? How do they knock her down on that one?
Since they already said her claimed injury was iffy, indirect, they went on to say that even if they sided with her, even if they said, UW, you messed up, these rules are invalid, it wouldn't actually solve a real problem that Margaret Allen herself had.
Because the harm wasn't concrete enough in the first place.
Right. They didn't see that direct connection between you didn't follow the procedures and she got hurt because of that.
So three strikes and she's out. The court didn't even consider if the UW actually violated the APA.
Nope. They stopped right there.
But wasn't there a dissenting opinion? Didn't one of the justices disagree?
Oh, absolutely. Justice Sanders had a whole different take. He wrote a strong dissent.
Lay it on me.
Especially about whether Margaret Allen had enough skin in the game, so to speak, to have standing. He really zeroed in on that community property thing, her shared financial interest in her husband's job.
Which seems pretty logical, right? If my spouse's job is in jeopardy, it affects me too.
And that was his argument. Any changes to how her husband's employment works, including these disciplinary procedures, they directly hit her pocketbook too, because it's community property.
But the majority didn't buy it.
They drew a line in the sand. They said, look, the professor, he's got his own individual rights under the faculty code. That's one thing. But Margaret's interest is in his salary. And that's kind of a secondhand effect.
So one step removed.
Exactly. They felt that was too far removed to give her standing in this specific case.
Interesting. So they're getting pretty technical with how direct the harm has to be.
They are. Justice Sanders, though, he felt that community property thing was much more direct, a clear legal stake that should have given her standing.
So a difference of legal opinion.
Absolutely. And Justice Sanders also disagreed on the procedural injury front.
Right, right. Remind me about that.
Margaret Allen said, look, the UW didn't follow the steps, the notice, the comment period, all that stuff the APA requires. That in itself hurt me. She's saying she was denied the chance to participate.
And Justice Sanders agreed with her on that.
He did. He said when someone's claiming a procedural injury, like being shut out of the process, the bar for showing direct harm should be a bit lower. His reasoning was those procedural rights, they're valuable.
They're not just window dressing.
Right. He's saying being denied them, that's a harm in itself, whether or not you immediately feel the effects of the rule change.
So he's taking a broader view of what constitutes harm.
Definitely.
But the majority, they stuck to their guns.
They did. They made it crystal clear. A procedural violation alone isn't enough. You have to show concrete, particularized harm, something tied to that specific violation that directly affects you, the person suing.
So you can't just say, they didn't follow the rules, I'm mad.
Right. You've got to show how that messed you up specifically.
That's a pretty high bar.
It is. And the court's saying, even if the university maybe cut some corners, since Margaret Allen couldn't show how those shortcuts directly hurt her, her case couldn't move forward.
So it's all about connecting the dots, from the violation to the specific harm suffered.
Exactly. And that's why this case is so important.
It really sets a precedent.
It shows how strict Washington courts are about standing. They're not messing around with indirect or speculative injuries.
And they're making a clear distinction between a procedural oops and a real-world injury.
Right. But that dissenting opinion, it raises some interesting questions. Justice Sanders was worried that this exemption for university employment rules, if it's interpreted too broadly, could let them make all sorts of changes without public input.
Changes that might affect students, the community, not just employees.
Exactly. But because Margaret Allen didn't have standing, the majority didn't even rule on whether the exemption was valid in this case.
So that question is still out there.
It is, kind of looming.
Okay, so let's bring it all home. What are the key takeaways about standing from Allen v. University of Washington?
Three biggies. First, to fight a public entity's actions in court, you need to show direct personal harm. It's got to be about you. Second, just pointing to a procedural flub, like they skipped a step, that's usually not enough. You got to connect the dots to how that flub harmed you specifically.
Mm.
And finally, those APA exemptions, they exist, but how far they reach, that could be a bit of a gray area, ripe for debate.
Makes sense. So if you're ever thinking about taking on a government agency, a school board, whatever, first question, do I even have the right to be here? Have I been harmed?
That's a gatekeeper.
So for all our listeners out there, food for thought.
Yeah.
Our legal system is trying to balance two things, letting people participate and hold public entities accountable, but also preventing courts from being flooded with cases from people who haven't really been directly hurt. How does this case, Allen v. University of Washington, how does it change how we see future challenges to how rules are made? It's definitely something to ponder.
Definitely.
Thanks for joining us. This is a great deep dive.
My pleasure.